actually should do. And of course, I look then forward to our discussion with you, Raminta, Joanne, and Rolake on this. So, impact. Well, when it comes to treatment, and I'll just focus on AIDS here, all of you remember just 10 years ago in Durban, many were actually skeptical that treatment could or even should be provided to the developing world, and had a long list of arguments against providing and expanding treatment. People were saying drugs are too expensive, treatment is not cost-effective, we don't know whether the patients will be actually compliant to the treatment. People were saying there are no infrastructures, there's no healthcare workforce. People were saying if we rush too much introducing treatment at large scale, this will lead to resistance. In other words, all of the arguments saying it could not or even should not be done. Now here we are, 10 years later, and 7 years after the Global Fund was created, and ultimately, clearly, all of these claims proved wrong. And today it is 5.2 million people who are on treatment in low and middle income countries, of which 2.8 million are supported by the Global Fund. The Global Fund currently supports around 50 or a little over 50% of all patients on antiretroviral treatment in Africa, and close to 75% of all patients on antiretroviral treatment in Asia. And so clearly we've made huge progress, and we should acknowledge that and celebrate that. And that doesn't mean that we should be blind to the challenges ahead of us, but we have to acknowledge that, because that means that we have proved the feasibility of scaling up at large scale, something that people again were clearly doubting. But in addition to being a public health success, to me the massive rollout of antiretroviral drugs is perhaps one of the major human rights victory that we have had in the first decade of the 21st century. And think again of Durban. This was the context when access to treatment was put forward as access to a basic human right. And in that respect, again, massive scale out of antiretroviral treatment in the developing world is also a major human rights victory. And I would like to here congratulate all of you today, and particularly my fellow panelists, because I exactly know who they are and what they have been doing in the last few years. Congratulate all of you who've been champions on human rights and champions on treatment for these successes. But we've also made huge progress in prevention. And don't forget, the Global Fund is sometimes perceived as a fund for treatment and not funding prevention. We've made huge progress in prevention. The Global Fund is the primary, has been the primary, and Raminta, you would agree, maybe the only or almost the only funder of harm reduction in Eastern Europe, for example. It clearly, at a global scale, by far the largest funder of harm reduction in the last years. It's the primary multilateral funder of preventing mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And the impact of prevention at large we're seeing, and I really welcomed with you all of the news about decreasing incidence of HIV/AIDS among the young population in Africa, for example. And then, and I know I'm speaking to a convinced audience here, I'm using this sort of artifact of talking about treatment and then prevention, but when we all know, and we particularly realize at that conference how much treatment is also prevention, and therefore I wouldn't like to in any way to be seeming like going into the totally useless debate about treatment versus prevention. I'm just mentioning all of the areas that we're funding and how ultimately all of this is impacting But that funding, that is AIDS funding, as you know well, has also been key funding for strengthening health systems. Many of the small clinics, many of the improvements in access to laboratory testing and structures, many of the health workforce in the developing world has been financed with this money going to AIDS, TB and malaria. So again, let's not oppose in any way, on the one hand, health system strengthening, on the other, vertical funding for AIDS and or TB and or malaria. We are very much in an integrated way of moving here. And it's for the countries to decide what they wish. And as I just said in another session just before this one, it's interesting to note that when it comes to HIV/AIDS, and I look at our entire portfolio worldwide, and that's over 120 countries when it comes to HIV/AIDS, what the countries have requested is an average of one-third of their money going to treatment, one-third of their money going to prevention at large, and one-third of their money going to health system strengthening. The same comment I would just briefly make around maternal and child health. Let's not again pitch one against the other. How could maternal and child health be an issue considered separately from the issue of AIDS or malaria when we know that over 50% of the deaths of women in childbearing age in Africa are due to HIV/AIDS, when we've all read the Lancet paper showing how much AIDS impact on maternal mortality in Africa, and we know that 90% of the deaths from malaria occur in small children below the age of 4. However, instead of building of these results on these results and the impact I just mentioned, what I have been hearing some of these days is, again, some of the skeptics, voices of the doubters and the skeptics. Just as in year 2000, I talked in another session yesterday about some vicious sort of hostility there. Again, let's be very careful not to be listening to those voices that are just as in the year 2000, voices of the doubters and voices of the skeptics. I'm certainly not one of those doubters or those skeptics. We have proven collectively that we can provide treatment to everyone in need. There isn't a country in the world now, even in some of the poorest countries and even in countries in conflict, where somehow treatment and prevention isn't coming with Global Fund funding. But we're, of course, not saying that. I'm not in any way denying some of the current realities, including the economic crisis. But I don't want people to say that because there is an economic crisis, we can't continue to scale up. At least not at the same pace as we have been scaling up in the same years. Some other people are saying that the effort is unsustainable. Some other people are talking about a treatment mortgage that donors will have to pay in the long term, which I think is a truly very negative and inappropriate term when what we have done is actually to save lives and actually provided hopes to millions of people, and when at a time when we should actually be celebrating our successes and building on those successes to move further. So there's clearly a backlash that I am witnessing, a backlash, including at this conference and from some of the key speakers at this conference. There is a backlash on treatment, and to me that backlash is also a backlash on human rights, and we have to resist it. instead of turning people away from treatment centers or putting them on waiting lists, something that we know, and many of you have heard, is already happening in too many places every day. We have to continue scaling up. So again, of course, I realize donor countries face economic difficulties, but let's also think that and keep in mind that the poorest countries are the hardest hit by the crisis, and even disproportionately more than the rich donor crisis. So we shouldn't allow this crisis to increase the inequities again. And clearly, unless we strongly act now, we really risk to undoing the progress that we have achieved since Durban and since the Global Fund was created years ago, and has actually become, I believe, the world's most powerful vehicle to reduce the inequities between health, between the rich and the poor, between the North and the South, and hence has become a powerful vehicle for the realization of human rights. Let me just turn to human rights now. And as I said in the very beginning, talking about these three words, impact, Global Fund, human rights, or these three sets of words, I really think what the Global Fund does, what we do, because I keep saying, and you probably heard me already saying, that the Global Fund is our Global Fund, it's our collective instrument to fight the diseases. What we're doing with the Global Fund is all about promoting human rights. So let me briefly go through a few key areas here in what the Global Fund is doing in terms of human rights. First, as in too many countries, and it's recurrently being discussed at this conference, women, girls continue to be subject to violence, denial of sexual and reproductive health services, property and inheritance rights, and the basic means to protect themselves from HIV. This must change, and this is why the Global Fund has come with a gender equality strategy. Gay men and other men having sex with men, transgender persons, sex workers, all suffer from a wide range of human rights abuse, and this is why the Global Fund has come with a gender identity strategy. And the Global Fund is also focusing now on people who use drugs and on the Eastern European epidemics. And this is why we recently launched an initiative to increase access to prevention and treatment for people who use drugs, including in prisons and in pre-detention trial centers. And I hope when it comes to me particularly, I hope you feel that you can count on me for that advocacy on human rights, whether it's by signing the Vienna Declaration and encouraging others to do so, speaking at the rally yesterday, speaking to the president of Malawi a few weeks ago, or talking about drug detention centers this morning when I met with the vice premier of Vietnam and the Vietnamese delegation. And finally, let's be clear, there's a lot we can do more and better. And I do recognize that the lack of support for programs that promote and support human rights is one of the key failures in the response to AIDS, and that's one area where, as a major funder of AIDS, we can help improve the response. Rights-based programming puts the needs of women and of the most marginalized populations at the center. It addresses not only their most immediate health needs, but recognizes, for example, that providing legal assistance, something again we discussed with some of you this morning, may be as important to a person who injects drugs as a needle or as a condom. We have included recently some guidance into some of our documents, for example, for those of you who may know it, our fact sheet on services for people who inject drugs, and in our CCM newsletter. But I know we must step up this effort and highlight the importance of human rights programming in each national strategy or plan. And then let me just turn to you briefly, Joanne, about what you called, and here let me quote, the heart of the Global Fund's human rights dilemma, which is espousing human rights principles while also being committed to allowing HIV responses to be primarily driven by countries. And indeed, when it comes to the Global Fund, it is firmly committed to both, to, on the one hand, human rights-based programming, and on the other hand, to the very principle that responses must be driven and owned by countries rather than imposed by the funder, by donors. And that dual commitment, admittedly, to human rights and country ownership sometimes poses challenges, particularly when countries, of course, fail to implement human rights-based policies and programs or have written policies that actually undermine these rights. But one thing is very clear, and I would like to make very clear here. We do not support and will not support interventions that are not evidence-based or that infringe human rights. Finally, let me say, and I'm sure we'll go further into that discussion in a few minutes. Finally, let me say that a few weeks ago, when I spoke in Toronto at the invitation of the Canadian Legal Network, HIV/AIDS Legal Network, I said that we should use this conference, the Toronto conference, to reinvigorate the AIDS movement as a human rights movement, just as the Durban conference did 10 years ago. I said we need a new and strong and united call for human rights, for continued and ambitious scale-up of treatment and prevention programs now more than ever. And I think that last night, with all of you, I saw the beginning of that. Now we need to make it really happen and sustain it. I think this is one more key, 10 years after Durban, one more key moment in the history of the AIDS response where we can bring together the AIDS response and human rights. It would be a human rights and public health disaster to turn our backs on millions of people in need. So ours is a movement for health and justice. Ours is a movement for human rights. And I'm glad to say I can hear that movement becoming vocal again. And these were the few remarks I wanted to give before we enter into the debate. Thank you, Rolake. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much, Michel. Thank you. Thank you so much. Forgive me. Because I know Michel so well, I think I just took it for granted that we all know him. Michel is the executive director of the Global Fund for AIDS, TB and Malaria, based in Geneva, Switzerland. And unfortunately today, we're unable to have the Minister of Health from Ethiopia. He could not make it to Vienna. So his name is out there on the program, but he sends his apologies. He's not in the country. He's not at the conference. Next, we have Juan, who is an associate professor at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York. She was the founding director of the HIV/AIDS program at Human Rights Watch and was executive director of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. She's worked on health and nutrition programs for UNICEF for over 70 years. And Joanne is
seven.
Happy.
Seven years.
No, 70, it can't be 70.
70.
No, she's not 70 years old.
Almost, though.
She definitely hasn't worked for 70 years. She's worked for over 7 years. And she's proud of the fact that she's lived in Africa for over 10 years. Joanne, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to offer these remarks today in solidarity with our good colleagues, Drs. Arash and Kamyar Alai, who now have been incarcerated without good reason, unjustly, for more than 2 years, linked partly to their work as pioneering AIDS physicians. I hope you all will get to know something about this case at the website iranfreethedocs.org, and if you are so moved to join us in signing the petition. The remarks that I will give today come from an analysis and reflection that I did on behalf of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network and the Open Society Institute, and I thank my collaborators and reviewers and overseers and commenters in this process. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a dream. Yes, I know that that's not, as a rhetorical device, very original, so with apologies to Martin Luther King, this is, as you will see, a remarkable likeness of me having a dream. And it is a dream of money, not money for me, though that's also quite a nice dream, but money for human rights-based programs for HIV. And my dream is of a big, fat, and I mean by that well-resourced, big fat funder with very much a global scope who is interested in HIV programs but is an unusual funder because it really understands what rights-based programs mean. It understands that that doesn't just mean putting the word rights-based in your mission statement, or it doesn't just mean inviting a sex worker now and then to a meeting. It means something deeper than that. And in this dream, this funder actually invests in understanding what kinds of human rights violations stand in the way of good HIV programming, HIV prevention, care, and treatment for everyone. And when the dream big fat funder finds in country X, for instance, that it's impossible to involve sex workers in HIV programs because the police harass them so much and they are so hyper-criminalized, as an example, this big fat ideal funder says, well, country X, you know, we're in a position to scale up, help you scale up your programs better than any funder out there can do. And we respect your sovereignty, but we have some principles about these things, about programs that we bring to scale. At the very least, what you need to do in this case is to demonstrate to us in some way that you're at least on the way to addressing these problems that are standing in the way of HIV, rights-based HIV programs. And we expect that the actions that you'll be taking in any way are consistent with your human rights obligations that come from the human rights treaties that you've ratified. And if you can't do that, well, you know, maybe we're not, at least for the moment, so interested in being your funding partner. But maybe we can help you work through these things in some way to remove these barriers. So this is it's a pretty good dream, you know. I think maybe dreams have no place in a serious discussion like this, but I think it may be legitimate for us in some way to ask, how close is the Global Fund to that dream, or how close would the Global Fund like to be, or could it be, to such a dream of that big fat funder? The question actually goes seriously to the heart of a central inquiry at this conference, which is, what is the meaning of real commitment to confronting HIV in a human rights-based way? In this analysis, we looked at three aspects of the Global Fund's work: the grant-making processes, the grants themselves, program content, and the advocacy that the Global Fund has done on human rights-related issues of concern to HIV programming, which by any reckoning has become much more important in the Global Fund since Dr. Kazatchkine is there, and we are grateful to him for that. We were, as he suggested, particularly interested in this balancing act of a kind that necessarily follows from this dual commitment, this potentially conflicting commitments of commitment to human rights and rights-based programming on the one hand, and also commitment to country ownership, country-driven processes on the other. The dilemma, again, as he said, is clear. If countries driving the country-driven processes are set upon ignoring or undermining human rights, rights-centered programs will very likely be impossible. I just want, because the time is short and we do want to have discussion, to mention a few selected results from this reflection that we undertook. The CCM mechanism itself, I don't need to tell you what it is already something of a human rights statement on the part of the Global Fund. It's a statement that said it didn't want to deal only with governments. It wanted to deal with a structure that would include civil society, UN agencies, and so on. And where this works, it's very much an important bit of progress in rights-based programming, I think. Where governments, though, still dominate CCMs, and this really is still a problem in a lot of places, some of the same places where governments repress AIDS-related civil society organizations, there needs to be some attention to that. And maybe it's in the form of greater availability of non-CCM grants or something, but I know it's something that the Global Fund is concerned about. On representation of people living with HIV, the Global Fund has a rule about that. That is something where I guess the Global Fund felt strongly enough that this is something where countries' CCMs need to be challenged. There has to be somebody living with HIV on CCMs. And indeed, that has happened, and it's an important step, very much reflecting the JEEPA victories over the years. As for key affected populations, and I think we all know what those are, but notably, obviously, people who use illicit drugs, sex workers, MSM, transgender people, mobile populations, and so on, the record is a little bit more mixed. And indeed, one has to be concerned that in places where there is hypercriminalization of even minor drug crimes, of sex work, of transgenderism, of homosexuality, the organizations of those populations often cannot even be officially registered. How can they participate in CCM processes? They often can't get money. They often don't have the capacity to be able to do what you need to do as an active CCM member. This is a real concern to us if we are serious about rights-based programming. Women's rights groups as well. There are a lot of accounts out there from women's organizations that have had a lot of problems being taken seriously in the CCM. And Dr. Kazatchkin spoke about how the Global Fund has addressed this. Yet it remains a big challenge. Another challenge that's related to that, that we think is worth highlighting, is that many women's rights organizations, and I can assure you that women's rights organizations have a hard time finding funding for HIV-related work, even though we know so well that subordination of women is a main driver of HIV, that women's rights organizations in CCM sometimes feel as though they are pushed into a service delivery mode, maybe because of the kinds of performance indicators that are used, rather than being able to do rights advocacy if that's their specialty. Scaling up controversial programs, there's very good evidence that through various kinds of suasion, interaction, whatever it might be, the Global Fund has been influential in getting some countries to adopt things like methadone therapy, absolutely crucial. Again, Dr. Kazatchkin has been an important advocate in this regard. There is also some concern that sometimes a tokenistic commitment to those programs appears kind of to keep people off their back or whatever it might be. And we need to be worried about scaling up these programs. We wonder if there's some way that the Global Fund might think about encouraging that kind of thing strongly. With the rest of these points, I'd like to go ahead and say a few words. Again, I agree with Dr. Kazatchkin. His leadership, both as the president or the chairman, I guess, of the first technical review panel of the Global Fund and in his current position, has been crucial in setting the precedent for funding for needle exchange and opiate maintenance therapy. The figures are here. It's an extraordinary achievement. And yet we still have the concern about the participation of people who use drugs themselves in these processes, and even organizations that represent their interests, harm reduction organizations. This really leads us to the concern, the more general concern that I mentioned before, of how one deals with these situations where it's clear that criminal law, whether it's in sex work, in drug law, or whatever it might be, is standing in the way of being able to mount any kind of real rights-based response to HIV. We wonder if this is an area where the Global Fund might be able to be a little bit more assertive or even directive than it is now. In the Global Fund's gender strategy, which Dr. Kazatchkin referred to, there are, for instance, rather detailed guidelines about how a CCM might do a gender analysis. Could that kind of thing, for instance, be required for thinking about how exactly criminal law stands in the way of, first of all, people's participation in CCM processes, and secondly, their representation of their interests in funded programs? Could something on that order be done without challenging too much this idea of country-driven programs. I am so delighted to hear that Dr. Kazechkin was able to do, as it were, national-level advocacy with the representative from Vietnam at this conference on the matter of detention centers for drug treatment, very much in quotation marks. These are places, in case you haven't heard some of the seminars that have been given here about this terrible phenomenon, where drug users are involuntarily detained. The treatment that is given really is in the form of forced labor, often with physical abuse, and nothing that we would call scientifically sound or evidence-based treatment. Dr. Kazechkin has already spoken about this challenge, the challenge of learning, I guess, that Global Fund money has gone into services in these institutions at some times, and we appreciate his concern. We do think that in addition to very serious national level advocacy to close these institutions, because they really must be closed, the Global Fund may need some kind of clear policy to determine if it is going to continue to try to help the people who are in these centers. I have to say myself that personally I find it hard to know how one does services in these centers without legitimizing them in a way that may be counterproductive. Maybe there's a way to have a time-bound plan toward closing them or something, but we hope that the Global Fund will be working on this question as it thinks further through its strategies related to drug use and HIV. I did not want to fail to say something about 100% condom use programs, because I think not enough has been said about these. This is another category of programs that the Global Fund has supported in a number of countries. 100% CUP, as many of you I'm sure know, are programs that are meant essentially to make commercial sex transactions without a condom illegal. That is to say, all transactions, and they especially usually target brothels and nightclubs and other entertainment venues, must be transacted with a condom. And this usually involves the police, because again, it's a matter of making unsafe encounters illegal, essentially. The problem that one has with, from a human rights perspective here, is that these programs are generally completely top-down. They are normally designed, as far as I know, all of the ones that are out there have been designed without much in the way of meaningful participation of sex workers. The Global Network of Sex Work Projects, the Asia-Pacific Network of Sex Workers have all really denounced these programs, been very concerned about the human rights violations against sex workers that seem to have accompanied these programs. We hope that, again, in this case, when CCMs promote the use of Global Fund resources for such programs, there might be a way to get them to reflect, perhaps even as a requirement, on the kinds of human rights protections that might be possible. And also, we know that there are very much rights-based alternatives to these programs, because we have seen the amazing achievements of sex worker-run collectives, and we'll hear more about that for those of you who are interested from Mina Seshu in tomorrow's plenary. And here I will allow, in defense of the Global Fund, that this is not an area where WHO has done its job in giving us good rights-based technical guidance. We learned on the UN Advisory Group on Sex Work and HIV that I'm part of that WHO will be revisiting guidelines in this area, but we don't know how long it will take, and it's an area of great concern for programs in HIV and sex work. We also know that from the beginning of this epidemic, HIV-positive women have been, in many cases, encouraged not to become pregnant. If they are pregnant, have been coerced to have abortions. They have also undergone coercion to be sterilized against their will. In Namibia recently, there have been documented cases of involuntary sterilization in hospitals that were receiving Global Fund support for vertical transmission programs. Obviously not something that anyone could foresee at the time those grant agreements were made. Nonetheless, a heinous human rights abuse, and this is the kind of thing where one would hope there would be a kind of process for responding to the abuse, being sure that there is an investigation, perhaps pushing CCMs to have riders in the grant agreements that talk about the rights involved and how to protect them. Again, I won't take the time to talk about the gender strategy. I think it's great that the Global Fund has developed strategies with respect to women's equality, as Dr. Kazatchkine said, as well as with respect to what the Global Fund calls SOGI, SOGI, sexual orientation and gender identity, which also includes concerns about sex workers. I would say that also the Global Fund has community system strengthening lines of funds and the so-called dual-track financing policy, which it seems to regard in its documents as a possible other ways to make up for, to increase civil society participation. And we hope that those programs, as they are developed, will be evaluated carefully with respect to the needs of key affected populations, especially criminalized people. I don't have time to talk about advocacy. Dr. Kazatchkine has been an important advocate on many difficult human rights concerns. We need his voice as we are in a time, if you heard Ellen Tahun this morning, of yet more challenges in preserving the generic drug industry, in preserving affordable right to treatment. I think that there are a number of other areas, and there some of them are listed here, where we could use more advocacy. So for us, I think it's hard to reconcile this dilemma. We recognize that this is difficult. We think there may be possibilities for actually pushing CCMs more than they are pushed. We know that the Global Fund has the potential to provide groundbreaking leadership in situations where criminal law has been such an impediment. And that's laying a lot on the Global Fund, but that is the commitment that seems to be made, and we hope that will stay firm. The advocacy voice is important, and also we hasten to say that obviously UN agency representatives, others who aren't on CCM, should be working in this direction as well. Since I plagiarized Martin Luther King at the beginning, let me go on and to plagiarize him and say, remind you that he famously said that the arc of history tends toward justice. We have almost 30 years of an historical arc of country responses to HIV, and I would suggest that those responses tend toward justice only when they are kicked pretty hard in that direction. The Global Fund has not hesitated to intervene in country-driven processes in cases of corruption or mismanagement of funds. As a practical matter, it seems to me that the outcome of corruption is very similar from the point of view of rights-based programs for HIV to the criminalization of drug use or sex work or homosexuality or transgenderism. In both circumstances, you really can't expect that rights-based programs will work. Of course, none of this discussion is worth anything if the Global Fund doesn't have resources, so I join my voice with the thousands others here in favor of a hearty replenishment for the Global Fund, including a contribution from our host country to make up for its lack of support in the past. The question really is, which human rights problems have the gravity to lead the Global Fund to step back and think about whether it wants to be putting fuel in this country-driven vehicle, or maybe to know a little bit more about where the vehicle is going before it fills up the tank. We think perhaps that there should be a wider range of such issues than there are now. It would indeed be a terrible setback for the world's confrontation with HIV, for the considerable leadership, human and financial resources of the Global Fund not to be brought to bear as much as possible in shaping exemplary rights-based programs. That, anyway, is the dream. And when we dream, we should dream big, maybe even big and fat. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Roy. Thank you so much. Raminta. Interesting what we've heard, and I'm sure you've listened to Michelle and you've listened to Chuan. You're a senior advisor with the Eurasian Harm Reduction Network and European AIDS Treatment Action Group, and you're also on the Policy Working Group co-chair for the EATG. Tell me, are you in any way linked with the Global Fund at the country or regional level?
I'm trying to be as less linked as possible directly, but my linkage is through advocacy work. because many civil society groups, as Joanne said, they became implementers. They became so much in the system that many groups are not able, John did not say that, but some groups are not able to speak about the issues, to advocate the governments, because they became the implementers, they became who are delivering treatment. So how can they demand from government some treatment? And on this, if you allow me to continue,
yes, go ahead.
We've heard fantastic issues what the Global Fund has done. We have seen a lot of issues in Eastern Europe, the impact. We've seen, for example, in Ukraine, that possibility to introduce methadone substitution, or in many, most of Eastern European countries and Central Asia. It was possible only because of the support of the Global Fund. Of course, leadership also on the ground, but it was mainly through that. And we've seen, in general, human rights brought into discussions around HIV, even sometimes without mentioning human rights. This is what Global Fund does. It says, like, let's speak about evidence base, let's speak about services, let's speak where is HIV epidemics. So it managed to bring human rights even without talking about this. But this progress and this impact is also fragile. So Eastern Europe and also Middle East, North Africa, Latin America, and many other regions are very much affected by the recent processes that the Global Fund is not fully funded and those limited resources are so-called prioritized to who needs the most. So some regions become completely neglected. And it's not to say that not all that we shouldn't focus on the countries where we have the major epidemic. But it's the issue that in some countries we started very good work, and as Michelle said about harm reduction, often it's the only funder. It's the only funder in most of the countries. It's the only funder that brings human rights issues, that bring men who have sex with men in Middle East and North Africa, or bring sex workers issues in Asia Pacific. And we are basically losing it. So what happened in round 10 is that there is a special reserve channel, so-called for most at-risk populations. And that is the channel that has indicates that you can apply there for serving most at-risk populations. So serving their human rights, providing services, providing essential services to people who are the most marginalized. But there is major ceilings for each of those grants, and there are very limited grants that are possible. So what was happening over the summer, because we all are rushing for the round 10 to submit applications, is that many countries were counting. So how many applications could be supported? Whose application will be first because of prioritization, new criteria, epidemic, etc.? And countries where have less epidemic, they already are punished now because they won't be able to get money from Reserve Fund because it's only 15 grants if they requested maximum that will be supported. And we have much, much more countries that will be applying for that. And this eligibility issue is something that, of course, is bouncing issue depending on how much money we have. But it's the issue also related with donors. Donors want to promote human rights. Donors want evidence-based services. And donors want that there are services for people in their home countries and that their borders, for example, I'm from Eastern Europe, so that EU borders are sort of safe from HIV because there is major epidemic in Eastern Europe. But on the other hand, when we are asking donors, so what is the solution for countries that are becoming non-eligible? And we asked also European Commission's DG Development on Monday, they are saying we have to find some special solution. I'm sorry, but they are saying these things like for two last years at least, and they are never finding them. So they're never sitting down with Russia,
Let me ask, based on what you've said, what would be the specific policies or interventions or programs that you would like to see in place that will ensure the rights and promote the rights of marginalized groups. Specific policies now.
One of the policies to keep those countries that are eligible still now, eligible. And to fund that. And not to put the ceilings on demand. Because what's happening now, we are trying to say that actually, no, we don't need so much money for HIV. This is what might happen, because all countries are trying to say, oh, we need only that amount of money, and we won't see demand. So the first issue is to eliminate for the next round most at-risk population special reserve fund and to fully fund the global fund for all eligible.
Thank you very much. I mean, and it boils down to one reason. Why are we going into eligibility and who should be funded and who should not be funded? Looks like everything boils down to this money problem. And it's as if where money is concerned, we begin to place and say, so which life is more important and which one should we be saving? And I hear you on that. Michelle, based on what do you have to say to this? You're executive director of the Global Fund. I know you're not the chair of the board, but you are executive director. And Ramantha has said some amazing things. Tell me, what do you have to say?
Well, I'd like to be very clear on this, and I hope everyone understands me and hears me at being very clear on this. I do not see how we could reasonably conceive a global fund that would not be global. So we're dealing with global epidemics. We need a global response, and to fund that global response, we need a global fund that is indeed funding access to treatment, to prevention, care and support wherever it is needed in low and middle income countries. I can't be clearer than that. That said, yes, I have a voice as executive director of the Global Fund, and I want to make that voice public. I have also a voice as a non-voting member of the board. All of you are voting members of the board somehow, and please remember that. You're all represented on the board. Several of you, and I welcome the message from the MENA region here. You're represented on the board both regionally and with a board member who is representing the civil society organizations from the south. We just need to build that critical advocacy. We need to do two things. First, we need to build the advocacy so that the board doesn't become threatened by the financial issues in order to take decisions that would be key decisions when it comes indeed to human rights and to the way we actually conduct the HIV response. I think the two matters should be kept separate. The matter of financing is a key issue there, but the decision on keeping the Global Fund an instrument for all of those who need it in low and middle income countries together, to me, is a question of principle around the Global Fund. That decision should be taken independently of the economic and financial context. When it comes to the economic and financial context, there are two things we need to do. One, of course, is all of us to advocate and work hard, whoever we are, wherever we are, on having a global fund that is fully replenished. But also, we have to address the legitimate question of whether countries, of how countries that should have the means, to the financial means, to answer, to respond to concentrated epidemics, if they were to have the political will, commitment, why would those countries just receive money from the donors without actually somehow participating in that funding process? So I really wish that we work hard, not on whether middle-income countries should or should not be eligible, but how can they be eligible, that is, find the right conditions for them to to co-fund the programs. And personally, what I advocate for is that the middle-income countries are both beneficiary of Global Fund programs and contributors to the Global Fund. And this is what I'm currently asking from some of the emerging economies. I was in China recently. I'm going soon to India. I'm talking to Brazil, to Mexico. But actually, I would like to address every single middle-income country and ask them to have their share of the burden. If they do not show that share of the burden, it will be more and more difficult to dissociate the two debates. And under the pressure, our board and the donors may well say, okay, in those conditions, let's prioritize. Although, you could also ask the question, and I have no answer to the question, how is a dollar better invested? Is it where it's most needed, or is it where it will be bringing the most leverage on the response?
Thank you, Michelle. John, I'm going to ask you this question before I take this out to other people and have people be a part of this conversation. We've been having these conversations. Tell me, how can we really monitor the impact, the human rights impact of Global Fund grants if we really will ensure better outcomes? What are these indicators we should be looking for?
I should probably have said more about the fact that UNAIDS has identified a number of human rights interventions that it feels to be important in national responses to HIV, especially in places where key affected populations are marginalized or criminalized, and those include things like access to legal services, stigma and discrimination programs, fighting violence against women, Know Your Rights kinds of programs. There are a number of other ones, but direct human rights interventions. That is one way to look at how effective the message has gotten through about human rights-based programs. And as I think Dr. Kazachkin said himself, it's somewhat disappointing to see how rarely those kinds of interventions show up as priority items in proposals from CCMs. I think, though, that perhaps the model of the gender approach, the gender strategies that the Global Fund has taken, is one that we should be looking at carefully. There hasn't been so much a spirit of requirements on CCMs, but a lot of encouragement to CCMs to do capacity building, to do gender analysis with a lot of guidance about what that analysis should be. Could we think of something like that with respect to the other areas where people have a very hard time getting some central human rights concerns, central human rights concerns of key affected populations into the process? And I wonder in that regard, I would like to hear Dr. Kazachkin's thoughts. Could there be some kind of resource? I know you're not trying to build a big secretariat, but some kind of resource that would help countries settle disputes or get technical assistance, or just have the reflection about how much criminal law in the cases that we cited is really standing in the way of good programming.
Thank you. Michelle, before you take that, I'm going to ask a volunteer from the group. I know your lips are sealed, but I need somebody to answer that question. So I'm playing the devil's advocate. We've just been told some middle-income countries really need to put their money into the fund as well. I've had donors talk about this. How can China be getting money from the Global Fund? How can you have this country? So I'm playing devil's advocate. If you would use mic number 2 behind you, please answer that question. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Rolake. I understand the situation that it's not normal that people who have resources do not invest and rely completely on the Global Fund or other financial institutions. However, we all know the situations in our countries, in Latin America, in Eastern Europe, in Middle East and North Africa, these countries who are affected by this question of eligibility criteria, who can change the situation? Civil society. If we do not invest in civil society, if we cut the funds for civil society, who will do the advocacy? We are not advocating only for rich countries to fund the fund. We are always, in each meetings in our countries, we are trying also to ask our governments to invest in money. We are living in different countries. This advocacy is very difficult to do, but it is going to be even more difficult to do, otherwise impossible to do if we kill today civil society organizations in our regions. So those who are promoting the change of eligibility criteria, they are punishing success. The situation has completely changed from 2002, where the Global Fund has been changed. For us, the Global Fund is resources to put programs that are needed in our communities that are discriminated, marginalized by our government in Eastern Europe, in Latin America and Caribbean, and in Middle East and North Africa. But the Global Fund is not only money, it's also a way to work. Countries who do not respect civil society are obliged today to sit in the table with civil society in the CCMs. So what we need today is to invest in civil society. The Global Fund must continue to support. We are here to support the Global Fund, to fully fund the fund from rich countries. We are also advocating so that our countries respect their commitments. But if we cut the fund, we are not going to punish the government who do not invest in their population. We are going to punish most at-risk populations who are already marginalized and discriminated, and the Global Fund is going to punish them. So changing the Global Fund eligibility criteria is simply, for me, punishing success. I like Michel Kazatchkine very much, but I hope that this is not the last time when I will call him Mr. the Executive Director of the Global Fund, and that next time I will see him, I won't tell him Mr. the Executive Director of the Poor Countries and High Prevalence Countries Fund Against AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I hear you. And like we've been told, who can make that difference? Who can ensure that these things happen? Who can ensure that whatever criteria are set are those that are people-friendly? Ramitha said something. She mentioned inability of civil society organizations who do advocacy work to meaningfully engage with CCMs, because once you become a grantee, you become compromised. And you said you're trying to, you know, distance yourself from that. Now, Othman, you've talked about if we need to fund civil society. So I need someone to help me. How do we fund civil society in this context where the CCM is seen to be severely compromised, where civil society members or groups on the CCM are seen to be compromised? How do we get this going? Remembering that the Global Fund will not tell you what to do, it must be country-driven. Global Fund will fund whatever comes from the country. If you can, there are different mics. There's a mic here, number 3, there's a 6, there's a 2, a 5. Number 2? Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you. Richard Elliott from the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. I think part of the question is perhaps already answered. There is, in fact, an ability to have non-CCM funding from the Global Fund that has been used on occasion to support civil society groups, especially in situations where the relations between civil society and government have been particularly troubling, and so it's not been realistic to rely upon governments, including the broader spectrum of stakeholders in the process. I think the question perhaps more is, what sorts of things could we and should we be funding through those mechanisms to address the human rights issues that are often at the root of the problem?
Sorry,
and that
Richard,
make the Global Fund investments in different areas less effective?
Sorry, Richard, I don't want to interrupt, but let's be very clear. Yes, indeed. Global Fund can fund directly the civil society outside the CCM, but in the eligible countries only. So if we lose on eligibility, countries that would lose eligibility would not be countries where we would be able to fund directly the civil society. I just want to make that clear for everyone.
No, you're absolutely right. And I'm speaking not so much to the question that was just being addressed about which countries are eligible, but more the question that was just being posed about how do we make sure that civil society can be involved. Obviously, that's an issue for countries about eligibility as well. Can we look then to possibility where, assuming, let's set aside the moment for the debate about which countries are eligible, let's assume that we resolve that and that, in fact, at the end of the day, as we've just heard, those countries do remain eligible. Where there is eligibility for civil society groups to seek funding, could we look at some specific initiatives that actually fund those groups to document the kinds of human rights abuses that we don't want to see when we say that the Global Fund will not fund programs that are not evidence-based but also that violate human rights? How do we make sure that that happens? One of the ways is to fund the groups that are in a position to document some of those things and then bring those to the attention of a funder like the Global Fund. Groups that can document the impact that these kinds of repressive and punitive laws have on the ability to do effective HIV prevention and treatment with these populations.
Thank you.
Can there be some specific initiatives there that would actually help us achieve that goal?
Thank you very much. So I'm going to go to mic number three. And remember what we're talking about. What I need to know is, how do we do this in the context of where the Global Fund is right now? So there is round 10, we have round 10 proposals being written. Looking at human rights, how do we ensure that civil society is supported, advocacy work is supported, and that we're able to get this work done? Mic number three.
Hello, Rolake, Michelle, Joanne.
Sorry, please tell me your name and your affiliation.
Yes, my name is Amir Reza Moradi. I'm from Iran. I'm a member of the CCM, also National AIDS Committee, and I'm a representative in the community delegation to the Global Fund. I'll get back to your question, but regarding the eligibility criteria
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to this that particular one. Don't let's do the eligibility criteria now. Let's try and answer this immediate question. How do we ensure that human rights programs are formed? Are funded if civil society, the part of the CCM responsible for bringing forth the proposal, are seen as compromised? And I'm happy you sit on the CCM and you are from civil society. How can we get this done?
Well, I think especially in our region, Middle East, North Africa, and as my colleague Othman mentioned, the situation regarding civil society, we might be middle income, but we're poor in civil society regarding the funding available to us. I think Global Fund should look into more in the CCMs and do a performance indicators. I'll give you an example for Iran. Last year, we only had 2 meetings for the CCM. As much as the Global Fund is pushing for more seats available for non-governmental organizations in the CCM, the government somehow is trying to have limited meetings, so they still have the control in a country which all the settings is governmental run, basically the service providing. So I think we need CCM performance indicators clearly, and one of the indicators could clearly be a number of meetings in each year and how the civil society performed in that. But getting back to please allow me to tell this, that regarding the eligibility criteria.
If you're going to do eligibility, I'm going to give you 1 minute for eligibility.
I don't need 1 minute. It'll take less than 1 minute. I think we shouldn't just look on national income. In our specific region, we should look into the percentage of that national income being spent on health issues. So health expenditure in our countries, Middle East and North Africa, is a very great indicator to see how much of the national income is being spent on the people. So that's something.
Thank you very much. I'm going back to mic number six. Before I go to mic number six, I want to say something very quickly.
I want to say actually 4 at least things that are already taking place, and that could be some good practices that could be done even more.
Okay.
So on one hand, we have civil society groups that manage to balance advocacy and service implementation role. We have those examples, the same Ukraine, where legislation was changed with leadership of civil society and legislation, not on something like simple, but on drug policy. And that was civil society, that was implementer. They were forced, in a way also forced to do that, because otherwise they wouldn't achieve what they committed to achieve. We have also examples of regional proposals from networks, which are too few, because it's so hard to get funding for regional proposal, too hard to build the proposal, too hard to manage it, and the procedures, of course, have to be lowered down. But this is something that we have to keep in mind and to encourage that.
Are you talking regional civil society proposals?
Regional civil society proposals, specifically on marginalized groups, because now it's a little bit complex where and how they could receive support. And probably this is answer in a way only. Also to Middle East, North Africa, we saw that in Latin America and Central America, and hopefully at some point we will see also in Eastern Europe and some other regions. And then also monitoring and evaluation is one of the key tools that Global Fund manages to do with services to make principal recipient, CCM, but also principal recipient, to be legally responsible for implementation of some indicators. And why don't we include indicators on legislation around marginalized groups or about human rights programming or how many human rights violations are reported? Into that, into bigger, greater accountability mechanism. And in addition to that, to have national funding criteria, as Michelle indicated, and national funding criteria, and also a colleague, I think, from Iran was making the point on that. National funding, not just for general HIV, because what's happening in Eastern Europe, I don't know about other regions, is that this national funding that is shown as co-funding is usually for what? For hospitals, for doctors, for doctor salaries, but almost never, I think never, for marginalized groups. So something maybe to ask them as co-funding for human rights is also some possibility.
Okay, Michelle, I hope you're listening, because I mean, all of this we're asking ourselves, how can we make this more effective? So microphone six, the sixth mic, permits me to change the tweak this question a bit. Tell me, I don't know if you are you familiar with what is called the SOGI strategy, sexual orientation and gender identity, that the Global Fund
I am, yes.
Okay, so tell me, how do you think that we can bring in the SOGI strategy into countries where you can't even begin to talk about sexual orientation and gender identity, where it is a taboo and it's against the law, yet we're talking human rights? How do you imagine that this can happen? Your name, your affiliation.
Okay, it's David Traynor. I'm with the Communities Delegation to the Global Fund and from Australia. And Relaki, I'm afraid you've caught me on the hop. I haven't prepared for that question. But I actually have a question for Michelle, which is broader and may actually, to some extent, answer that. Michelle, I was wondering whether you could answer for me. It's my understanding that under the current cost-sharing criteria within the eligibility policy, that lower middle-income and middle-income countries are required to focus their programs on key affected populations or most vulnerable populations. How is the Global Fund monitoring this? How can the Global Fund improve its monitoring of these obligations? And can it actually be mandated that some of this investment actually goes to strengthening communities and particularly advocacy around decriminalisation?
Thank you. Mic number two.
Yes, I'm Catherine Severo from the Grant Management Solutions Project. Since January, there's a new opportunity to enable civil society organizations to participate more actively in country coordinating mechanisms for the governance side, not just for the implementation side. Because under the new Global Fund funding policy for CCMs, more of CCM budgets can be devoted to mobilizing civil society constituencies and enabling them to meet to provide input to CCM activities, including oversight of Global Fund grants. And I would just hope that CCMs are seizing that opportunity to actually finance civil society consultation, finance civil society participation in proposal development, and finance communication toward the population. Now, if they are also including civil society members actively in oversight activities, this will enable civil society to include in oversight these very issues that are concerning us right now. So in the round 10 screening of CCMs, I hope that the Global Fund will really pay particular attention to looking at those oversight plans and those CCM budgets to see if those civil society activities are included.
Thank you. Mike, number three.
Yeah, thank you very much, moderator. My name is Louis Edema. I'm from Nigeria. I'd like to share Nigerian experience with the group as concerning the participation of civil society, more of participation of civil society in Global Fund activity. Like in Nigeria, the civil society have been able to put themselves together, put their acts together, thereby finding themselves in the role of sub-recipients in implementation of round five. And now, even as I speak, in the approved grant of round nine, the civil society has been able to, you know, come together and put their acts together, their own together, to come up as a principal recipient, to, you know, contest as a principal recipient. These are avenues where the civil society can really come to this center stage and see themselves participating in Global Fund activity. And that's the case in Nigeria now. The civil society have been selected as a principal recipient to the implementation of even round nine. And that's a great effort on their part to seeing that they participate fully in Global Fund implementation, and also to then getting funding to carry on their even civil rights activities. So that's an experience. That's one thing I think this group also can, lesson they can learn from. Thank from the Nigerian you. Experience, where the civil society have been able to come together,
Thank
have been able
you.
To put their acts together and bring in, put a meaningful contribution into the Global Fund implementation.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Mike number two.
Thank you. Andrei Klepik of International HIV/AIDS Alliance Ukraine. International AIDS Conference set an agenda, a topic for the next 2 years. And what I'm hearing during these days is a test and treat slogan or approach. I think this approach is very risky to take without deep thinking, especially in our region. It's based on just a mathematical model. It mostly relates to generalized epidemic. But this conference we are having mostly related to Eastern Europe and Central Asia context. And there is a huge risk that this message will be taken by our government officials back home, applied for round 10 application, and thus necessary prevention elements, including harm reduction, methadone-based substitution treatment, can be cut off at all. In this context, and anticipating this risk, it's very important that you and Professor Kazachkin especially reinforce importance of the prevention, because one of the messages we would like to back home from this conference, that actually focused prevention works. Ukraine, the country I am from, is a live proof example of this. And it's done mostly with the Global Fund support. As Raminta said, this success is fragile. So it's really needed to be supported in Ukraine and in the entire region to demonstrate its full success. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to take the last comment still from that mic number two and then come back here.
Yes, hi. My name's Bernard Rivers. I run AIDSPAN, which is a watchdog of the Global Fund, and we produce the newsletter Global Fund Observer. We're based in Kenya. When the Global Fund started, the CCM was a very bold experiment and a very exciting experiment and a very difficult experiment. And one of the biggest difficulties was conflict of interest by governmental members of the CCM. You had cases where a Minister of Health or a permanent secretary from the Ministry of Health would be both the principal recipient and the chair of the CCM. And everyone recognized the need to confront this, this conflict of interest. I'm not sure that it was handled very well, but at least the conflict was recognized. At that time, civil society members of the CC, or civil society organizations in those countries, this is several years ago, had very little expectation of getting Global Fund money. So they provided actually a very healthy role on the CCMs. They were watchdogs, they were advocates, advocates for doing what's right and for not doing what's wrong. Then along came the dual track funding concept, where it became much more easy for civil society organizations to receive money from the Global Fund. That was fantastic. I fought for it. I endorsed it. I applauded it. But the result is that you now have civil society members of CCMs whose first priority is fighting to become sub-recipients, or in a few cases, principal recipients. And the watchdogging and the advocacy for what's right and the advocacy against what's wrong is happening much less. CCMs are now a hotbed of conflict and of politics and of fighting for the money. And I think this needs to be recognized. I think many of us who are fighting for dual track didn't see this coming. So I certainly didn't. And I think civil society needs to now, at some level, whether it's the board or within the individual CCMs, work out a conflict of interest policy for themselves, where they can actually provide a good example to the governmental members, a conflict of interest policy where they say that on certain issues, certain organizations either should not be on the CCM or should not vote on certain issues. I think if this issue of conflict of interest among the civil society CCM members is not acknowledged and confronted head on, the CCMs are going to become even more chaotic, and I use that term deliberately, than they are at present. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bernard. I'm with you 101% on that. We need to have a CCM, not just a reform, we need to have a revolution on that CCM, because it looks as if that's the easiest place to get your interests served. How on earth can you be responsible for a grant? You write, you approve the proposal, you are the primary recipient, you are the one doing the monitoring and evaluation, you are the one doing all of these things, and we expect some kind of accountability, which means we must have clear rules. If you are a sub or primary recipient, you have no business on the CCM. Let the CCM be exactly what it was meant to do. So I'm going to, we've had questions, we've had comments. Is there somebody there? 1 minute.
He says no.
1 minute, 1 minute.
He says yes.
Sorry, Rayaki, 1 minute. I just want to ask Michelle Kazachkin that people from Middle East and North Africa, Latin America and the Caribbean and Eastern Europe want him to speak publicly about the eventual consequences that if these countries cannot eligible. Because the public opinion doesn't understand for them where it's middle-income countries, so then they have to invest. But they don't know the question of human rights, that this money goes to most at-risk groups, etc. So we expect from him, we need, when we ask him, that publicly, during the following weeks and months, to speak about this, because the public opinion doesn't understand this issue. And thank you, and sorry.
Thank you very much. Okay, so let's wrap this up. There are two things clearly that I'd like for us to take out of this. What needs to be done in order to make, what's the value of integrating human rights into the Global Fund thinking process? the grant making, the advocacy by the Secretariat. What are the things we need to see to scale up on HIV prevention, care, and treatment? And then what do we need to do in order to make human rights happen routinely, not something that we have to fight and scream, that should be part of the systemic things we have in the fund? So in addition to, I'm sure we have comments and answers from the floor. I'm going to start with you, Joan.
Well, I think Michelle has been asked a wide range of questions, and probably we don't have much time, probably should get the chance to speak. I guess I would come back again to this idea of how seriously do we take human rights violations that stand in the way of responding effectively to this epidemic? This is what this conference is all about. Again, not meaning to put everything on the shoulders of the Global Fund. It's the most important mechanism that's out there for certain kinds of programs, especially ones that are politically unpopular. That does put a huge responsibility on the institution. And I hope that part of, I hope that after a hearty replenishment, it will be a big priority for the Global Fund to think carefully about guidelines that maybe become, in some cases, more than guidelines and requirements of institutions that clearly are not getting it, that serious structural barriers, criminal law, social marginalization, complete disdain for the people most affected by HIV are all standing in the way of programming in the same way that corruption does in some places, and those are not necessarily mutually exclusive. And being active, even assertive, in dealing with those issues, and also in a transparent way. And I think that that means also that the Global Fund will need to engage with civil society on the ground in ways that will help make those responses be reality-based and lead to good programming.
Thank you. Aminta, 2 minutes.
So what human rights gives to all of us is sustainability. If we implemented human rights and if we managed to get national governments to start implementing that, it's actually something that is sustainable, much more sustainable than just providing services, and we would see major impact. And we have seen that, for example, in Estonia, where now human rights are, which were supported when it was still eligible, which was supported by the Global Fund, and where we see that human rights situation now is changing. It's completely changing. And I wanted to answer a little bit, if Michelle is not against, on the issue of conflict of interest in CCMs. This sounds like small issue, but it's big issue in terms of that we have civil society that is implementing, and we have also watchdog functions. And I agree a lot with that. And the way how it could be addressed, there was one discussion very recently in Kyrgyzstan where civil society discussed that there could be and should be implementers, but they want one at least civil society organization that does not receive any money from the Global Fund. But it's not always possible, because in many our countries, it's very hard for civil society to get any funding. There are not many donors.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Thank you. There are indeed a number of questions, and I apologize because of time. My answers will be succinct, but let me first turn again to this issue of eligibility. And let me say again that to me, a global fund has to be global. That's very clear. We also have to work all together to find the best conditions under which that message can be understood by our board. Othman, you're giving me a huge responsibility. I'm ready to speak publicly, but before we go to the general public opinion, we have to focus on our board. And our board is you also. All of you, through, again, I repeat, the civil society delegations, your regional delegations, you are represented also in the current working group that is defining and discussing this eligibility criteria. It's not the national press somewhere that we do it. It is that group and that board. Second, when it comes to co-funding issues from in middle income countries, you're absolutely right. Middle income countries are funded by the Global Fund to primarily address the issues of the most marginalized and vulnerable populations. They're asked to show that they co-fund these activities, but as Raminda said, that what they show is money that somewhere then disappears in hospitals and in other things that are not actually focusing on the very interventions and the very activities where we need them. I would, however, hesitate. Someone said whether we should some of that co-funding something should be mandated to, or countries mandated to focus on. Really, I don't want the Global Fund to be an institution, a donor, a funder that engages with countries based on conditionalities and mandatory requirements. The Global Fund is supporting the countries. The weight must be on the countries in the way they manage, decide, and struggle to manage and decide. But the times when it's for the donor somehow to put the rules on the others, I think these times in general in development aid should be over. Thank you for the comments on the CCMs. I think that's a very interesting discussion. I was going actually to say what you just said, Raminta, that I fully agree that those policies of conflict of interest should be clear. We should clearly have civil society representation that is not civil society implementers on the CCM, just as you said, Bernard, that we're now facing the same sort of conflict of interest as the one we were denouncing when ministers of health were both chairing CCMs and the principal recipients of many grants. But that is not always easy. And then I would really turn to Joanne maybe for one more additional comment, because conflicts of interest is about ethics. And ethics is not providing a set of rules or solutions. Ethics is about debating the difficult issues. And perhaps you could help us move in this area, difficult area, of how can you be both a member of the CCM sometimes, or an interested party, and an implementer. I think Richard Elliott has opened a number of avenues on how to think further on having human rights in the programs and funded programs by the Global Fund. I really, Joanne, appreciated the analogy you gave with corruption. And that has really opened my thinking. And I really think we should perhaps think more along these lines than think about more conventional lines of putting human rights-related indicators in what we ask people to report on. Because all of you who sort of applauded saying we should have more indicators and indicators on human rights are also the same people who keep saying to the Global Fund, please, less indicator, less reporting, less bureaucracy. And so we have a tension and a dilemma there that we have to address. And finally, for our colleague from Ukraine, I fully take your point. You're absolutely right. Let's be very clear. What the message from this conference about treatment and is prevention is that when you treat a large population in a generalized epidemic, indeed you deplete the reservoir of the virus, therefore you decrease the transmissibility, therefore you will impact on the epidemic. And that's documented in models and is now being documented in the real field. But Ukraine and some of the concentrated epidemics are clearly demonstrating that if we focus on the right population, for example, with addressing harm reduction at large scale in a country where 70% of the epidemic is driven by IV drug users, then indeed we can impact the enormously on the epidemic. And this is the reason why all of us are so sad about the current situation in Russia.
Thank you very much. Was John going to say something? Are you good? Okay, thank you very much. It's already 4 o'clock, past 4. The session, unfortunately, is over because it's 4 o'clock and we really must wrap this up. The session ends at 4, right? Yes. So I'm very sorry. I really am sorry. It's 4. I apologize. Please do forgive me. Let's remember who funds what the country calls illegal, what is not legal in the context of that country but needs to be addressed. How does it get funded? CSO composition of the Global Fund. Who really are the civil society members sitting on the CCM? Apart from the sexy, easy to work with networks, do we have sex workers on the CCM? Do we have ID users on the CCM? Do you have MSMs on the CCM? Especially in countries where these groups are criminalized. Who is picking for them? So when we talk about CSO composition of the Global Fund, who really are these people and what do they speak for? Finally, let me put off my hat as a moderator and put on my hat as the alternate board member for communities living with AIDS, TB and malaria on the Global Fund. I do want to be eligible. Unfortunately, we are the only group where we do not have the luxury of being regional. So we are not a region. We really must represent everybody infected and affected across the globe. And which means that for us as a community delegation, it is important that everybody has access. So this is an ongoing thing. And once again, please, for those of us who really are interested in these things, can we go find our regional groups? Can we find civil society on the Global Fund and engage with those groups? Because that's the only way our voices can be brought to the Global Fund. Thank you very much, Michelle. Thank you, Joanne. Thank you, Ramintha. And everybody, thank you very much for spending your time with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Renate.